Still grieving over the death of his wife? Oh, you know about that. You wouldn't be another police officer, would you? Hey there, wonderful people. How you doing? This is Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster, bringing you the Mystery Hour here on Sundowns of Arizona. Treat to have you with me. Ellery Queen's latest mystery magazine and Bill Pronzini bring us the first story of this show. It's called Tangled Web. The Sunrise Hills Country Club was pretty much what Runyon had expected. Probably not the largest or most exclusive in Marin County, but still a playground for the wealthy set. A long drive flanked by shade trees led into it from a country road that ran along the lower edge of the hills that had given the club its name. The drive ended in a large pair of adjacent parking lots, one for members and the other for guests and visitors. This being a warm, sunny Saturday morning in July, both were jammed. Runyon drove around the visitor's lot until he found a place to squeeze his Ford into. The main building sat on a rise above, a wide terrace across the front that probably wrapped most of the way around. Behind it, to the right, he could see outbuildings and some of the crowded greens and fairways, ponds and sand traps of the golf course. The grass out there was of such a bright green that the groundskeepers might have been injecting it with chlorophyll. Proof, if there was any needed, that both the long drought and water rationing were over. Runyon was not impressed. Places were just, well, places to him, to be noted and mentally cataloged if necessary, otherwise forgotten. This was his first time at a country club or at a golf course of any kind. The golf gene had been left out of him. Oh, he could understand why men and women enjoyed the game, but the only sport, if you could call it a sport, that had ever appealed to him was judo, and he'd taken that up at the police academy in Seattle as a means of self-defense. Stone steps led up to the main entrance. Inside was a security desk manned by an individual in a white polo shirt with Sunrise Hills stitched over the pocket. A discreet placard on the desk stated that all members and visitors were required to sign in. Runyon showed his credentials and provided a brief explanation of his mission. That got him admitted. But he still had to sign the book. He walked through the lobby, past the entrances to bar and restaurant, people in golf outfits and expensive casual wear. All the faces were white. The only blacks, Hispanics, and Asian Americans you were likely to see in a place like this were lower-level employees. An arrow sign pointed the way to the pro shop. It led him outside to the rear, past a crowded terrace overlooking the links and a pair of occupied tennis courts, and then down another flight of steps. The pro shop was part of a smaller building in the center of a pair of wings that could house men's and women's locker rooms. Inside were displays of clubs and bags, balls, clothing, and other items, and behind the desk, a short, stocky man with half a head of thin blonde hair. He wore the same kind of polo shirt with club emblem as the desk man. "Joe Kresge?" Runyon asked. "Hey, that's me." He was the pro shop manager. "What can I do for you?" "Tell me where I can find Cole Landry." A faint scowl replaced Kresge's professional smile. "You have a lesson scheduled with him, Mr. Runyon?" "No, personal matter." "Well, I'm sorry, but he's not here." "Supposed to be. He's the club pro, and Saturday's our busiest day. We had to cancel two of his scheduled appointments."
"Did he give a reason for not coming in?"
"No, he didn't call in at all. I called his cell twice, but he had it turned off."
Hold up and not taking calls, evidently. Runyon had tried to contact Landry three times yesterday to set up an appointment for this morning.
and all three of his messages had been unanswered. He said, still grieving over the death of his wife, huh? Oh, you know about that? Well, you wouldn't be another police officer, would you? No, not exactly. An operative with a San Francisco detective agency retained by Great Western Insurance. To do what? Routine investigation. He could have told Kresge that Great Western required it because the Landrys had a substantial joint life insurance policy that contained a double indemnity clause in the event of accidental death, and Cole Landry had put in an immediate claim. But he didn't. None of the man's business. I thought that matter was settled, Kresge says. I mean, Mrs. Landry's death was just a tragic accident, wasn't it? That's what the sheriff's office determined. Runyon had spent part of yesterday afternoon going over the details with a sheriff's department investigator named Vasquez. The law was satisfied, yes, that Barbara Landry had died as a result of a fall down a flight of stairs after ingesting a lethal combination of alcohol and an opioid painkiller, tramadol, that she'd been taking for an impacted tooth. She'd been alone at the house at the time, and her husband had been here at Sunrise Hills all day with plenty of witnesses to back that up. No hint of foul play in any case. You mind if I ask you a few questions, Mr. Kresge?
About what? I don't know anything.
Well, you know Cole Landry, and I assume you've met his wife? How did they get along?
Fine, as far as I know. He was always saying how much he cared for her, and Carla, their 7-year-old, claimed he'd lost the love of his life when Barbara died.
Runyon understood how Landry must have felt. He had lost the love of his life, too, when Colleen died of ovarian cancer. He was also a father, but in name only. For complex reasons, he and his son, the product of a bad first marriage, had been irreconcilably estranged for many years. He had not seen Joshua in a long time, likely never would again. Kresge's mouth had quirked at one corner.
Well, not that Cole's feelings for his family stopped him.
Oh, stopped him from what?
A lot of attractive women come here to learn how to play golf or to improve their game if they already know how. And Cole is a handsome man, the kind some women... Well, you know.
And Landry took advantage whenever he could? Kresge said smarmily.
What man wouldn't when it's readily offered?
Runyon wouldn't have, when Colleen was alive, not for any reason. The disclosure of Landry's philandering took away some of the sympathy he had felt for the man, made him dislike Kresge, too. He asked, "Does he brag about his conquests?"
"Well, not exactly brag, but he's not closed-mouthed, either.
Kresge broke off abruptly as a heavy-set middle-aged woman in gaudy golf togs came in with a request for something Runyon didn't recognize. He pretended to examine a Sun Mountain golf bag until the woman completed her purchase and waddled out. Then he rejoined Kresge at the counter. "Who was Landry seeing recently?" he asked. "Any woman in particular?"
"Oh, now, I couldn't give out any names."
"Well, just between you and me, Mr. Kresge, in strict confidence?"
"No, I'm sorry."
Then he changed his mind. He glanced at the door as if to make sure nobody else was coming in before saying,
"Well,
all right. I'll tell you one woman he had an affair with, not a club member, a hostess in the greens room, Ellen Joyner." There was a spiteful edge in the way Kresge spoke that woman's name, a grudge holder's edge. Cole Landry had scored with her. Kresge had made an effort and been rejected. This was payback. Runyon asked, "Is Ms. Joyner working today?"
Yeah, I think so.
"The greens room? But you did not get her name from me, Mr. Runyon. Just remember that. I don't want to lose my job." "But you don't care if she loses hers," Runyon thought. He said,
I'll remember, and left the unlikable Kresge and the pro shop without another word. Green's room was a fancy name for the club bar. It was a big room divided into segments by vine-wrapped pillars with glass doors at one end that provided access to the terrace. A variety of golfing photographs and other memorabilia decorated the walls, and there were several potted plants arranged among the tables and separating a line of booths. As early as it was, just 10:30, the room was empty except for a barman conversing with a red-haired woman holding a serving tray and two men in shorts seated at one end of a horseshoe-shaped bar. When the woman saw Runyon come in, she immediately brought the tray across to a podium just inside the entrance. Hostess was another fancy name, he thought, this one for waitress. She was slender, attractive, in her mid to late 20s, conservatively dressed in a long skirt and a blouse with the club emblem on it. Her long red hair was the color of burgundy wine. She smiled and said, "Good morning, sir." "Well, good morning. Is your name Ellen Joyner?" "Yes." "I'd like a brief private talk with you, if you can spare a few minutes."
"Talk about what?"
"Your relationship with Cole Landry?" She stiffened and the smile evaporated. "Who are you, mister?" Runyon identified himself and explained his assignment. She gave him a long, searching look, holding eye contact the entire time. He was a big man, heavily featured. Some women found him intimidating, but Ellen Joyner was not one of them. Having him probe into her private life didn't intimidate her either.
"Did Cole give you my name?"
she asked. "No, I haven't seen him yet."
"Then who did?"
"Oh, it doesn't matter."
"Well, no, I suppose not. I can guess who it was anyhow. What are you after, Mr. Runyon?"
"Information. That's all. Nothing too personal."
"All right, follow me."
She led him across the room to one of the booths. When he was seated, she said, "Just a minute," and went to the bar. After exchanging a few words with the barman, she returned to the booth and perched on the edge of the seat. Runyon moved over to give her more room.
"I can't stay long," she said, "and I'll have to get up if someone comes in."
"I'll make it as quick as possible." She drew a breath, held it, let it out slowly.
"It wasn't special or serious," she said.
"What wasn't?"
My little one-night stand with Cole. That's all it was. One night, last December, we'd had too much to drink at a Christmas party, and he caught the stupid pass I threw at him. Big mistake on both our parts. He was as sorry as I was. He loved his wife. You know, he really did. Loved his wife and worshipped the little girl. They meant everything to him."
"So I've been told."
"But he can't resist temptation. Weak and thinking with his wrong head, like a lot of men."
"Did he have many affairs?"
"Well, not that started here at the club." She made a wry face. "It's hard to keep secrets in this place."
"Was he seeing anyone recently, before his wife's accident?"
Just one woman that I know about."
"A married club member?"
"Club member, yes. Married. No. Divorced."
"If you let me have her name," Runyon said, "I'll forget where I got it. I don't reveal my sources." It was half a dozen beats before she said,
"I shouldn't tell you, but I don't like the woman. For one thing, she and Cole's wife were friends. They'd come in together for cocktails a couple of times a week."
"Did Mrs. Landry spend much time in here?"
"Oh, she was a regular customer. But two drinks were her limit, if that's what you want to know."
"Why else don't you care for this other woman?"
"Oh, she's aggressive and arrogant. Treats the staff like slaves. Even more so now than before her own tragedy."
"Oh, what sort of tragedy? Her divorce?"
No. Her only child passed away of leukemia a few months ago. It didn't take her long to stop grieving and start coming to the club again or to throw herself at Cole."
Her name? Patricia Weaver. Do you know if she's here today?
If she is, I haven't seen her.
Where does she live?
Somewhere out near Point Reyes, I think, on Tamales Bay.
Runyon asked, was their affair still ongoing when Mrs. Landry died?
Yeah, as far as I know, it was. The last time I saw her, a couple of days before it happened, she was all over him.
Ellen Joyner put one hand on the table and pushed herself up off the booth.
That's all I can tell you, and I've been sitting here too long enough.
Thanks for your time and candor, Ms. Joyner. She started away, then stopped and turned back.
I hope you don't find some reason for the insurance company not to pay off. Not for Cole's sake, but for his daughter's. Carla, all he has left that meant anything to him.
The Landry home was in a newish, upscale development a dozen or so miles from the country club. Two-storied, made of white stucco and dark wood, surrounded by greenery on a large hillside lot. Over the tops of the summer brown hills, Runyon could see all the way to San Francisco Bay in the hazy distance. You'd probably have an even better view from inside the house. A garage, large enough for three cars, stood off to the left. He parked a short distance from it and followed a flagstone path to the house. No answer when he rang the door chimes. He leaned on the bell a second time, with the same result. Something caught his attention on his way back to the car, a faint, acrid odor that didn't belong with the summer scents. He stopped and stood with his head up, sniffing the air. Faint, that odor, and familiar, too. Too familiar. He looked over at the garage, and the hairs prickled on the back of his scalp, a sensation that worsened when he walked over that way. No question that it was coming from inside the garage. The double doors had no outside handles, electronically controlled and locked down tight. No window or door on the near side. Runyon hurried around to the far side. Doors there, but it was locked and jammed. Alongside it was a window, unshaded and clean enough to see through. When he put his face up close to the glass, he had a dim view of the interior. Gray haze filled it, the deadly kind. Through the puffy, hanging layers, he could make out one car, a green Lexus convertible with its top down. The figure of a man was bent behind the wheel, head thrown back and to one side. Runyon broke the window with his elbow. The seal in there must have been pretty tight. Stinking carbon monoxide fumes came pouring out, driving him back into one side. He went along the wall to the door and threw his weight against it. Jammed, not locked. It gave inward, scraping over the cement floor. He kicked it all the way open, releasing more of the gray poison, then ran over to the house and hunted up a hose bib and soaked his handkerchief in cold water. Back to the garage where the outpour through the door and window had thinned somewhat. He took a couple of deep breaths, slowly, held the wet handkerchief over his mouth and nose, and ducked inside. The man in the car wore one of the Sunrise Hill polo shirts, handsome once, but not anymore. Dead, long dead. His face was a bright, shiny cherry red. The monoxide was in Runyon's lungs, in spite of the handkerchief making him cough and feel a little lightheaded. He checked the back seat area to make sure Landry was the sole occupant before he got out of there into the fresh air. He stood sucking it in with his head down until he could breathe all right again. Then he hurried over to the house. The front door was unlocked. He went in and made a quick search of the rooms. Empty, all of them. Lieutenant Vasquez had told him Landry's daughter was being cared for by a Sunrise Hill Club member and neighbor, Mrs. Enderby, so the kid must still be with her and safe. Back at his car, he unclipped the flashlight from under the dash. There was something he wanted to check on before he notified the authorities. Something he'd noticed when he peered at Cole Landry's face up close. He soaked the handkerchief again before returning to the garage. The air in there was cleaner now, but still not breathable. He switched the flash on, held the beam on the dead man's face.
The eyes, wide open with the pupils rolled up, were like iridescent milk glass in the beam. The mouth hung open, an ugly rictus. Runyon used the edge of the flash to turn the corpse's head toward him. It moved loosely on the neck stem, and when he touched and then lifted one of the hands, it felt cold, rubbery. Rigor had come and gone. That and the fact that the Lexus's engine was no longer running, the tank drained of gas, indicated Landry had been dead since last night. There were three items on the seat beside the body: a half-empty fifth of Jack Daniels, a plastic pharmaceutical pill bottle, and a folded sheet of paper. Both the body and the car reeked of whiskey. Runyon did not touch any of the items. He'd been a rule-abiding detective, public and private, too long to tamper with evidence. Outside, he filled up with oxygen again. When his lungs quit hurting, he opened the Ford's driver's door, sat on the edge of the seat, and made his call. It had been the sheriff's department investigator, Vasquez, that Runyon talked to, and he came with a brace of uniformed deputies and an ambulance. He examined Cole Landry's body, took charge of the items on the front seat. Runyon had gotten along well with him, and Vasquez was not averse to sharing information. The empty pill bottle bore a pharmacy label identifying its prescription contents as Tramadol, the same opioid painkiller that had contributed to Barbara Landry's death. The folded sheet of paper was a short, computer-generated note that read, "Life has no meaning without the love of my life. I can't go on. This is the only way." Cole Landry's name was scrawled in ink at the bottom. Vasquez seemed to take it all in at face value. A planned suicide. Landry had sealed himself in the garage, turned on the car engine, washed down what remained of his wife's pills with the Jack Daniels, and passed out before the monoxide finished him off. Runyon was not so sure. Two people had told him that Landry not only loved his wife but worshipped his daughter. Why would he kill himself and make an orphan of her? And why had there been no mention of her in the suicide note? He said as much to the lawman.
Suicide is a selfish act, Vasquez said. Man drinks and broods enough, all he thinks about is himself and his own pain and sorrow. Besides, he made sure the kid would be well taken care of by putting in the claim on his wife's insurance, assuming the company you represent pays off.
Oh, they will. No reason for them not to.
You're not thinking Landry didn't take himself out, are you?
Well, just considering the possibility.
Of what? Homicide? Who'd want to kill Landry, and for what reason?
I don't know.
Well, Vasquez said, there's nothing here to indicate it was anything but suicide.
No, there wasn't. But it still did not seem right to Runyon. It had a staged feel, the whiskey, the empty pill container, the note all right there in the car with the dead man. There was something about the note, too, the brevity of it, the artificial triteness of the wording, the barely legible signature.
"Who are you going to investigate?" he said.
"Well, naturally, we won't find anything. You can go back to San Francisco. Your job's finished here."
"Sure," Runyon said. But his job wasn't finished. Not yet.
In the parking lot of a nearby shopping center, he called the agency office in the city. Tamara was there, as he'd figured she might be. She did not mind working weekends any more than he did. Preferred it, just as he did, particularly when she was between lovers, as she was now. A couple of workaholics, in his case because his job was the focal point of his life. He gave her a full report on his interviews and the discovery of Cole Landry's body, his reservations about the suicide verdict. He finished by saying, "Yeah, I'm just not satisfied. There's more going on here than it seems."
"Well, you want to keep investigating?"
"Well, unless you have another job for me."
"Nothing until next week."
Anything I can do?
Yeah, I need an address for the woman taking care of Landry's daughter, a Mrs. Enderby. She lives in the same development.
Well, that's easy enough. What else?
An address and some background on Landry's most recent lover, Patricia Weaver. Lives in or near Point Reyes.
That'll take a little longer, Tamara said. I'll get you the Enderby address first. Just take me a couple of minutes.
It took her 1.5. Tamara Corbin not only had exceptional organizational acumen, she was something of a technological wizard. Her computer skills were second to none in Runyon's experience. She made field work easier for him than it might otherwise have been.
I'll call you when I have the Weaver information, she said. Anything more you need?
No, not right now. Maybe later. The woman who opened the door at the Enderby address was a youthful-looking 50 or so, her tan skin free of wrinkles.
Yes, she said. She was Mrs. Violet Enderby.
He introduced himself, told her he represented Great Western Insurance.
Well, I'm sorry. We have all the insurance we need, she said, and started to close the door.
He said quickly, No, I'm not a salesman, Mrs. Enderby. I'm an investigator.
Investigator? Of course. The Landry's life insurance policy? Cole told me he'd filed a claim.
Yes, that's right.
He didn't and wouldn't tell her of Cole Landry's alleged suicide.
It was not his place to impart that kind of bad news, and it would only have made the interview long and difficult.
I just have a few questions, if you have time.
Oh, certainly. Come in, won't you? He followed her into a living room packed with shelves of old books. Mrs. Enderby explained that by saying, with some pride, that her husband, a high school history teacher, was considered an authority on Western Americana. Runyon accepted her invitation to have a seat, declined the offer for a cup of coffee.
"I understand you're caring for Mr. Landry's daughter," he said.
"Yes, and glad to do it under the circumstances."
"How is she?"
"Oh, she's fine. Of course, we haven't told her that her mother's gone. She's too young to understand."
"When did you last speak with Mr. Landry?"
"Last evening."
"In person or on the phone?"
"He called to ask about Carla."
"Was he alone, did he say?"
"No, he didn't, but I assume he was."
"How did he seem? Bearing up all right?"
Well as can be expected. He,
she sighed and shook her head.
"You've seen him, haven't you?"
"No, not yet. He wasn't at the country club today."
"What are you going to say, Mrs. Enderby?"
Another sigh. Then defensively,
"One can't blame a recently bereaved man for trying to drown his sorrows."
"Oh, he'd been drinking last night when he called?"
"Yes, but he wasn't drunk. I'd never known Cole to be intoxicated."
"Did he talk to his daughter?"
"Yeah, briefly. I don't know what was said, but he may have told her she'd be going home today."
"Today? Is that what he told you?"
"Yeah. He didn't come for Carla himself this morning. He asked Aunt Pat to pick her up and take her home."
"Aunt Pat?"
"That's what Carla calls a friend of Barbara's. Pat Weaver. She..."
Runyon's tight-set expression made her break off and then say,
"Is something wrong, Mr. Runyon?"
He said no, nothing was wrong, thanked her, and made a quick exit. But that was a lie. Something was very wrong. Patricia Weaver had not taken the little girl home.
There was a voicemail message from Tamara on his cell. She'd called when he was interviewing Violet Enderby.
"Patricia Weaver lives in Inverness, not Point Reyes Station, on the other side of Tomales Bay," she said. "Number 2, Storefront Lane. Nothing unusual in her bio, no criminal record of any kind. Age 31, born in Oakland. Married 10 years ago to a wealthy Tiburon restaurant owner. Contentious divorce 4 years ago. That got her custody of their only child and enough of a settlement to buy the Inverness house. Child died of leukemia a little more than 6 months ago."
There was more, but Runyon cut off the voicemail and called Tamara back.
"Patricia Weaver's child," he said. "Boy or girl?"
"Girl. Cynthia. How old when she died?"
7. "Sure," Runyon said. "Sure." Then he asked, "What kind of car does Patricia Weaver drive?"
Tamara was nothing if not thorough. She said it immediately. "A 22 Miata, dark blue," then gave him the license plate number.
"You on to something, Jake?"
"I think so. Hope so."
"Want to talk about it?"
"Not yet. It's complicated, a kind of a tangled web, and I don't have all the details yet. I'll let you know when I do."
Protocol said that he should take his suspicions to Vasquez, but the problem with that was the lack of hard facts to back up his suspicions. All he had at this point was speculation and circumstantial evidence. Even if he managed to convince Vasquez, it would take too long to lay it all out for the wheels to be put into motion. The other option was to handle it himself. Risky if it turned out that he was wrong. It could put his license in jeopardy. But the risk was worth it because of the little girl, Carla. Her safety was more important than any other consideration. He programmed Patricia Weaver's address into the Ford's GPS and headed east. The drive to Tamales Bay took just under an hour. He had been there before, on one of the extended driving trips he had taken after moving from Seattle to San Francisco to familiarize himself with much of Northern California and to satisfy his restless need to keep on the move, even when he wasn't working. The bay was 16 miles long and about a mile wide, flanked by dairy ranches and fishermen's cottages on the east side and on the west by wooded hills. A sprawling national park, windswept beaches, and the Point Reyes Lighthouse, farther out at the ocean. The village of Point Reyes Station was at the southern end. He passed through it and a short distance down Highway 1 to the road that looped around to Inverness. The day was not warm and sunny here. The sky was shrouded in fog, driven in from the Pacific by winds strong enough to whitecap the bay's surface. Shorefront Lane was beyond the hamlet, on a wide spit of land that jutted out from the muddy shore. It was less than 100 yards long, gravel paved. There were only 2 cottages on it, a smaller one near the main road and a large one at the outer end. Number 2 was the large cottage, weathered by harsh winter storms and the salt air, but otherwise well-maintained. Behind it, Runyon could see a short pier built on pilings sunk into mudflats that must have once been the property of a long-defunct oyster company. Decaying bedstakes poked up out of the mud like rotting teeth. Patricia Weaver was there. The vehicle, parked in the carport to one side, was her dark blue Miata, and threads of wood smoke puffed out of the chimney to be torn apart by the wind. He pulled up behind the Miata, pocketed what he needed from the console storage compartment, and then left the Ford and went to the front door of the cottage. She must have heard him drive in, even with the skirling of the wind, but he had to knock heavily 3 times before she opened the door a scant few inches. There was no chain on it. Good. She said in a voice as cold as the wind, "Who are you? What do you want?" He told her who and what he was, proved it by letting her see a photostat of his license. It made no impression on her. She said, "I have nothing to say to you. Go away," and made an effort to close the door. He prevented it with his shoulder, gave the door a shove that pushed her back away from it, and widened the opening enough for him to step inside. She stood glaring at him as he shut it behind him. She was a large woman, but not fat, well-proportioned, with wavy blonde hair cut short, casually dressed in a pair of designer pants and a thigh-length ski sweater. Her eyes were an icy blue, shiny now with anger. "You get out of here, or I'll call the sheriff and have you arrested for trespassing." "Go ahead. Call him, Mrs. Weaver."
She didn't move. Just kept on glaring.
The over-furnished room was too warm, a combination of furnace heat and a wood fire in an unscreened white brick fireplace. Carla Landry was not there. Napping, maybe? In one of the bedrooms?
Well, what do you want? Why did you come here?
Well, several reasons, Runyon said. All of them related. Let's start with Cole Landry.
Cole? His life insurance policy, that is?
No, that's not it.
What then?
He's been dead since last night, but then you already know that. Her only reaction was the twitching of a muscle under one eye.
How would I know?
She said. Then,
what happened? How did he die?
Carbon monoxide poisoning.
Suicide? Oh, I knew he was distraught over the death of his wife, but I never thought.
Oh, he didn't kill himself, Runyon said. He was murdered.
Murdered? Who'd want to kill Cole?
You, Mrs. Weaver. I think you killed him. The muscle jumped again. She backed away from him over in front of the fireplace as if she were suddenly cold. It was several seconds before she said,
"That's an outrageous accusation. Why would I want Cole dead?"
"Well, I can make a good guess. You've been having an affair with him. Don't bother to deny it. You wanted to make the relationship permanent. You couldn't talk him into it, and you're the kind of woman who doesn't take rejection well. That's one reason, but not the only one."
"I don't know what the hell you're talking about."
"Oh, sure you do," Runyon said. "You got him drunk last night, making sure he'd pass out. And when he did, you wrote that suicide note and forged his signature. Then took him out to the garage, closed it up after starting his car, and left him there to suffocate."
"Ridiculous! How am I supposed to have made sure he passed out?"
"By lacing his drinks with enough of what was left of his wife's tramadol. I think you did the same thing to her. Fed her a combination of liquor and tramadol, and then shoved her down the stairs so her death would appear to be accidental."
"You must be out of your mind."
The look of innocent outrage on her face might have been pasted on.
"Barbara was my friend. I had no reason to want her dead."
"I think you did. The same reason you murdered Cole. The motive behind both killings, it wasn't him you wanted. It was his child."
No, that's not true.
Carla Landry, 7 years old, the same age as the daughter you lost, a substitute for Cynthia. Patricia Weaver's control deserted her. She gave a violent shake of her head. Her eyes blazed, and she cried,
"Shut up! Damn you, shut up!"
"Where is she? I know you brought her here after you picked her up at the Enderbys this morning. You must have known you couldn't keep her here. What were you planning to do? Take her away somewhere? Raise her on your own?"
"Yes, Carla's mine now. She has no one else to take care of her."
Spittle dribbled from the corner of her mouth.
"Mine! I won't let you take her away from me!"
Runyon made the mistake of taking his eyes off of her as he turned toward the hallway that would lead to the bedrooms. In one swift moment, she snatched up the fireplace poker and lunged toward him, swinging it like a baseball bat. He saw the attack coming just in time to duck and dodge aside. If he hadn't, that poker would have crushed his skull. She drew it back to swing again, but he'd recover enough by then to grab hold of it and yank it out of her grip. The collision of his body with hers sent her staggering off balance. A throw rug fronting the hearth slid out from under her, and she toppled backwards and down into the burning logs in the fireplace. Before Runyon could pull her out, the flames seared her, singed her hair, and set the ski sweater ablaze. She shrieked with pain and fought him in a wild panic, clawing at his face as he tried to keep the fire from spreading over her body. He had to use a judo hold to subdue her. Then he was able to end the threat by smothering the flames with the throw rug. She lay whimpering and moaning. All the panic and fight was gone. She made no effort to stop him from removing the charred and smoking sweater. Her bare arms and shoulders were inflamed, but as far as he could tell, she was not seriously burned. When he was sure she would stay put,
He went to find Carla Landry.
The child was sleeping in the first of the bedrooms he looked into. All the noise had not roused her. The woman must have given her some kind of drug to keep her quiet. Pretty little kid, sweet-faced, one small hand cupped under her chin, and a lock of curly brown hair feathered over one eye. He wondered if she resembled the dead Weaver child. Cynthia? Maybe. He did not really want to know. There were partially packed suitcases on the floor in there, two large and one small. The small one had animal decals and contained child's clothing. Cynthia Weaver's, probably. The woman had intended to disappear with Carla, all right. He found blankets in the closet, took one of them out into the front room. Patricia Weaver had not moved. She neither struggled nor opened her eyes when he picked her up gently, laid her on the couch, and covered her with the blanket. Back in the bedroom, he wrapped the other blanket around the little girl, carried her out to his car, made her as comfortable as he could in the back seat. Then he called the sheriff's office and spoke to Vasquez, who said he would have an EMT unit sent out and come himself with other deputies and a matron. He did not sound pleased with what Runyon had to tell him. Well, that was all right. Before he reported to Tamara, Runyon took the digital voice-activated recorder from his shirt pocket, mini model, the size and shape of a cookie, 0.04 inches thick and weighing 0.08 ounces, and made sure everything that had been said in the cottage was clearly audible. None of it would be admissible in court, but it ought to be enough for the law to get a confession from Patricia Weaver and to protect him and the agency from any repercussions for his actions. He was thinking about Carla Landry still asleep on the back seat, wondering what would become of her when the EMTs arrived 20 minutes later.
All right, I'm switching over to the Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine, a story by Stephen W. Herring, and it's called The Family Man.
Sweet fennel sausages rolled into Herman Badiglio's hot frying pan and began sizzling right away. Oh, within minutes, his kitchen was filled with an aroma meant to soften the stony hearts of the brothers Gracchi, who sat implacably at the kitchen table. Herman did not want to begin his conversation until his guests were under the spell of his cooking. His simmering meat sauce had already enveloped the place with its spicy warmth. Now the sausages would do their work. Herman said, "As soon as the pasta water is ready, boys, I can get off my feet and maybe we can talk." The brothers Gracchi said nothing. Herman got the pasta going and turned the sausages before settling his huge bulk on a kitchen chair. He wiped his brow with a red checkered dishcloth.
"I ain't seen you boys since little Geraldine DeMauro's confirmation back last May," he said, just to get things going.
Then he looked at Carmine Gracchi, the older of the two, considered the family spokesman.
"I hear you did good work bodyguarding for Mr. Silva in Vegas over the winter."
Carmine Gracchi nodded proudly, pleased to have his standing recognized, but he did not speak. Younger brother Marco Gracchi did not speak either. He just looked mean. A long scar along the jawline delineated the meanness. Herman said,
"When you were away last year with my sister Rosetta, was engaged to be married, and when you came back east, you probably heard the engagement is off. The family is embarrassed. But it happens. Hey, I'm the first one to admit a Rosetta is a handful. Any guy should think twice before getting hooked up with her. I can say things like that because I'm her brother. Anybody else talk like that about her, well, I'll take care of them, you know what I mean.
The brothers Gracchi knew what he meant. They knew Herman Badiglio was a man of modest words and deadly capabilities. They both nodded carefully.
She was spoiled as a kid, Herman explained. Our father, may his soul rest in peace, was a lieutenant for the Lucchese's. There was money, prestige, she got anything she wanted. But we're growing up now, and things have changed.
He got up and worked on the meal. Then he poured the wine. The brothers were at their most vulnerable now, just before the food was served.
Herman sat down again and said, I hear Rosetta's been looking for someone to take a contract on her old boyfriend, Michael Feeney, and maybe she's talked to you boys about it.
We already took it, blurted Marco Gracchi. Carmine frowned his disapproval. Now he was forced to speak.
That's between Miss Badiglio and us.
Herman was pleased. He got the Gracchi brothers to speak. Their words were now on the table where he could work with them. He smiled and shrugged as if he could not help what he was about to say.
Carmine, Marco, listen to me. I'm the head of the family now, whether I like it or not. I will say this now, and then we will talk of it no more. I am canceling the contract. If Rosetta has paid you, you can keep the money, but the hit is off. Now, enough of such business. Let's eat.
And so they ate, in total silence. Herman Badiglio walked 5 blocks down Northern Boulevard to the shoe store where Michael Feeney worked. The day was hot, and the sidewalk was hot, and Herman was sweating heavily. He had to walk because he could no longer fit behind the wheel of a car, and his business with Michael Feeney was not the type of business to be conducted over the phone. Michael Feeney was one of 2 shoe salesmen on duty that day. When he saw Herman's wide form squeeze through the door, he quickly ducked into the back room.
Hey, don't be afraid, Michael, Herman shouted. We have to talk. I'm on your side.
Herman looked at the other salesman and asked,
Would you please bring Michael to me?
Bug-eyed, the young salesman fell over himself to carry out the order. Herman found a bench to sit on, as none of the regular customer chairs would accommodate him. The store was air-conditioned. Herman mopped his face with an enormous handkerchief and took pleasure in breathing the chilled air. Michael Feeney emerged stiffly through a curtain, propelled by an invisible force from behind. Herman waved the soggy handkerchief at him and said,
It's okay, Michael. You stay right there. I can talk from here.
I'm sorry about Rosetta, Michael said. I just couldn't go through with it. I want her to keep the ring. No hard feelings, you know.
Herman snorted a laugh.
Hard feelings is why I'm here, Michael. You better tell your friend in there to go get a cup of coffee or something.
Without missing a beat, the other salesman flew through the curtain and out the doors and kept running. When he was out of sight, Herman said,
You know what she did with that sparkler you gave her for an engagement, Michael? She sold it, and with that money she's taken out a contract on you. That's what she did with it. Now you're going to get whacked with your own hard-earned cash. Michael, now, can we talk some business?
Stunned and white-faced, Michael Feeney took a seat in front of his once future brother-in-law. All his fears about getting involved with a mob family were confirmed in spades.
Herman said, Look, between you and me, I don't blame you for breaking it off. As a wife, she would have eaten you alive, just like my Aunt Sophia and my poor Uncle Guillermo. But this was a formal engagement, a public statement, and there are rules with such things. Yes, there was a time when something like this would be a matter of blood for honor, but those days are gone. This is simple revenge. I gotta ask you something.
Yeah?
This breakup. Was another girl involved? Did you meet someone else?
Oh, no, Mr. Badiglio. And I have no one now. I just couldn't take the shrieking anymore.
Oh, good. Because if you did, the life of that woman would also be in danger. Now all I have to worry about is you. There are two thugs in our neighborhood by the name of Gracchi. They're brothers. You know them?"
Michael Feeney winced and nodded.
Herman said, "Rosetta asked them to pop you for her. So I cooked them a nice big meal and gave them my best wine, and I told them to call it off as head of the family, you know. I think they will respect my wishes, but there's no guarantee. Their deal with Rosetta could be more of a bond of honor than money. So, Michael, you might want to make yourself scarce. Let me work this out, but you can help by kind of disappearing for a while."
Michael Feeney swallowed and asked,
"Why are you doing this for me?"
"Well, Michael, to be perfectly honest, I'm doing it for me as much as for you. Trouble around here we don't need right now. Even if they never find your body, the police will come around to everybody you're connected to, and that means Rosetta, and from her to me, I can't afford that right now."
Michael Feeney said, "I'll be out here tonight." A few days passed without incident, and Herman began to relax a little bit. Michael Feeney was well gone and nobody knew where. Then the news came that Uncle Guillermo had died. Guillermo, it seemed, had finally succumbed to the merciless abuses and tongue-lashings of Aunt Sophia. They had been living in Florida for years, so Guillermo had to be shipped north for the wake and funeral, and to be buried in the family vault. Rosetta phoned Herman, distressed by the death in the family and seeking reconciliation with her brother. She wanted to meet him at the wake. Death often brings feuding families together this way. Uncle Guillermo was laid out in the big chapel at Germondi's funeral home. The chapel was a long marble hall with dim yellow lights and the smell of fading flowers. It was almost closing time when Herman stopped in, his bulk augmented by the thickness of a .375 Magnum strapped under his left arm. The hall was empty except for three women in black. Two small, frail figures in the front row were no doubt Aunt Sophia and her sister Aunt Beatrice. A younger woman was seated halfway back. The casket was open, and Herman could see the pasty white profile of poor Uncle Guillermo, hardly recognizable in death, projecting above the coffin edge. When Herman got halfway down the aisle, the younger woman stood and faced him. Rosetta's face was heavy with grief and rage. She leaned forward and hissed into his ear,
"That should be that bastard Feeney lying there with that pancake all over his face."
Herman shook his head and shrugged.
"Let it go, Rosie," he said, "for the family." "The family?" she mocked. "Papa would never have allowed me to be humiliated in this way. You have castrated this family. Goodbye, Herman."
She kissed his cheek and walked quickly out of the chapel. Herman Badiglio knew this to be a Judas kiss. He was not surprised that Rosetta had used this occasion to set him up. It made him rather proud. But for the moment, he was preoccupied with his own survival. His mind rapidly calculated the possibilities as he reached for the Magnum. In half a second, he knew where death would come from. He swung around just as Uncle Guillermo rose up from his coffin, bringing a snubby .38 special into view. The two old ladies up front began screaming. Shots were fired. The Magnum won. Except it wasn't Uncle Guillermo pulling the trigger. Herman stepped up to the coffin and wiped the makeup from the face of his would-be assassin. The long scar along the jawline confirmed the fresh corpse belonged to Marco Gracchi. Herman was not surprised that Marco would be the one to come for him. It was not a matter of money or honor. It was love. Everyone knew that Marco carried the torch for Rosetta, but she never gave him the time of day. Not until she needed him to take out the brother who tried to keep her from having her revenge against Michael Feeney. It was a weakness that Herman had feared and had prepared for. Love is a fierce but stupid enemy. Herman Badiglio holstered his Magnum and tried to calm his hysterical aunts. They would not be calmed. He slipped out the back of the chapel and into the night. He would have to find Rosetta before she found him.
All right, terrific people, thank you for tuning in to the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler here saying thanks again. Tune in again next time, if you would please. Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.